is Miles Camp Lassen. I'm a web editor at In These Times magazine. Got a table out there. I also contribute to some other outlets, Jacobin and some others. I'll be chairing the session and of course joined by two really incredible leaders here who I have had the real great luck and pride to watch up close in both of their campaigns and have seen not just how they were able to kind of summon great community support, but also take on the neoliberal establishment in Chicago and win. And that's Carlos Ramirez Rosa and Rosana Rodriguez Sanchez. So, thank you. Before we get started, I just want to give a few notes on kind of the format here, what we're going to do. We're going to try to run it as more of a town hall than a just straight up talk. So I want to leave plenty of time at the end for folks to ask questions. Of course, comments are very welcome too, but we want to be able to engage a little bit with questions folks have. People can get a little bit more in depth than we were able to do last night at the plenary. And give both Carlos and Rosana a chance to talk a little bit more in detail about what that vision for a socialist future in Chicago would look like. So to start off, I'm just gonna give like a brief rundown of kind of the political landscape in the city, where things are at, where we're going. I know you did not all come here to see me, so I'll be very brief. And then I'll hand it over to Carlos and Rosana to talk a little bit about that. We'll go back and forth with a few questions, and then for the second half of the session, we'll open it up to the audience. So I wanted to talk about, you know, last night we heard Jesse and others talk about Red Chicago being working class Chicago. And that's the vision that we all have. And I want to dig in a little bit into how we can achieve that. What is, you know, a reasonable expectation and what it means to be a socialist in office in 2019. So, we have like a strict 3-minute limit for interventions at the end, so I'll keep people on time and let you know and then pass it off. Yeah, that's it. Sound good? Great. First off, I think we should note how incredible it is we are all here. You know, it is not new, right, that there has been a socialist resurgence in the US. This has been happening for, you know, at least a year now. It's almost exactly a year after Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez won her race, her primary in New York. And, you know, I think it was a real inflection point. Of course, as Carlos noted last night, he didn't just get elected in 2019, he actually got reelected, which is a pretty incredible accomplishment for a socialist to get elected in the US. So, you know, there's Rashida Tlaib in Michigan, there's hundreds of other socialist legislators across the country. So it's very clear, I think, that the desire for a really bold left-wing alternative to the corporate Democratic Party establishment has taken hold nationwide. We can see that also in the campaign of Bernie Sanders, who's using his megaphone right now. You know, regardless of what you think of him as a candidate, he is definitely lifting up the socialist demands of housing for all, healthcare for all, education for all, basic concepts of treating these things as human rights. And I think that that's something that we've seen across the board with these socialists that have been elected to office. But you know, Chicago, so it's not the only location where we have socialist leaders, but we have seen something unprecedented in modern US history, and that is electing 6 socialists to city council, which has not been seen in a modern US city before. So that's pretty incredible. And you know, the electoral eruption, it's also taken place in the same city that Rahm Emanuel has sought to enact this neoliberal agenda on the city. So that's just to give some context of where we're coming from. For the past 8 years, Rahm has used his position as mayor to attack unions, including the mighty Chicago Teachers Union, of course, which fought back handily against him. Rahm also worked to privatize public services. He was giving out massive tax breaks to corporate giants, closing down public schools and mental health clinics, basically just like the vision of governance that is about pulling back funding for social programs and giving massive giveaways to corporate America. And if you want any, you know, evidence that that is Rahm Emanuel's actual ideology. You just see what he's doing now. I mean, he's now working as an investment banker at some boutique firm and writing op-eds in The Atlantic about why the Democrats need to take a hard right turn, basically. So we know that Rahm Emanuel's vision for Chicago is not the type of vision that is being lifted up by folks like Carlos Rosana and the other socialists on city council. And taking that on is really no small feat. I mean, Rahm clearly didn't do it alone. He was not some, you know, he didn't come out of nowhere. The whole political establishment in the city was backing him up for the most part. He had a rubber stamp city council. He had, you know, elements of the political establishment from the financial community to the police union on his side. So really in the face of this neoliberal assault, I think electing six socialists, it seems like a real political shock, and in a lot of ways it is. I mean, even members of the Chicago Democratic Socialists of America who were very involved in these campaigns were surprised, frankly, that we won as much as we did. So it was a shock in a way, but it also comes out of many years of organizing on the ground from social movements in the streets of Chicago that have been working to fight against police violence, to fight for immigrant rights, to fight for all sorts of things that are being you know, pushed now by these same people that just got elected to office. So I don't think we should think of this as just a freak occurrence. It really is the result of this rich tapestry of working class led movements that have been working in Chicago for many years. And the CTU obviously played a major role in that, along with plenty of other organizations. DSA, of course, the Black Youth Project 100, Masada's Daughters really led the way on fighting against police violence and corruption, the organized communities against deportation. It's been working for years on these issues, and lit the ban on rent control, many, many others. And these groups really laid the groundwork for the landscape that we have right now, where we are able to elect people like Carlos and Rosana. And they also helped to ensure that Rahm faced an early retirement, that he was no longer mayor of the city of Chicago. So I think we have to give credit there to these movements. And it's not just DSA, it's not just some socialists that did it, but it was, you know, all types of organized working class led groups and movements that made sure that Rahm was not welcome in Chicago anymore. And that is an incredible thing. In the face of this electoral transformation, though, I do think that we should be sober. There is still a financial class in Chicago that holds immense power over the economy. They didn't go away with Rahm. There's still a real estate industry that's going to fight tooth and nail to make sure they can keep their profits high, that we don't pass rent control in Illinois. There's still the Fraternal Order of Police and ICE, which is hell-bent on terrorizing immigrant communities and communities of color. And then, of course, there's still plenty of folks in office who don't identify as socialists and people who are actively opposed to the type of policies that are being pushed. So I think going forward, we've seen the impact that these social movements can have on the electoral arena. And we've also seen how the type of demands by these groups have influenced the platforms that some of what these candidates ran on. And I think that that's an interesting thing, that there's this kind of symbiotic relationship where the same groups that were involved in canvassing and doing door knocking and get out the vote are the groups that are now seeing their issues lifted up and put forward in legislation. And I think both Carlos and Rosana can go into a little bit more detail on that, but that is something that is fairly unprecedented. You know, when people think of Chicago politics now, traditionally, if they don't think of Rahm Emanuel and kind of this, you know, neoliberal vision, they think of Ed Burke and corruption, and, you know, Rob Blagojevich, or some examples of there being, you know, people abusing their power in office. And right now, the type of dynamic we see playing out is rather that the social movements are going into the halls of power, and that there's actual democracy in city council, which is something that has been a long time since we've really had in Chicago. So I guess I'll just end with one quick story. A lot of you might know that Trump has kind of a complicated relationship with Chicago. He seemed to you know, use our fair city as a boogeyman for anytime he wants to have some type of a racist tantrum, cites Chicago. But the city's people, you know, time and again have really they've repudiated him and his agenda. Back in March of 2016, I think probably some people in this room were there, the city's activist community helped to shut down a rally that he was planning to hold. People came together and they said, you know, you're not welcome. We don't want hate speech in our city. We don't want to promote this type of xenophobia. And just last month, we saw something else, which is that Trump delayed his planned raids on immigrant families and communities. And that was, you know, largely in response, I think, to the type of organizing that was going on the ground in those very communities to defend folks from the Trump's deportation regime. Now, I'm not saying that he has backed off entirely, who knows what Trump will do, but I think it's very telling that after groups sprang into action that he called that off and stopped it. So two of the people that were leading that charge, leading, you know, your rights trainings, canvassing neighborhoods, were Carlos and Mosana, right here. And when Trump called off the raids, he specifically cited Chicago and said, you know, of course he demonized Chicago somewhat, but it's clear he's aware of what's happening. So I think that means that our local socialist leaders are already helping to, you know, paralyze Trump's racist agenda, frankly, and they're also making him mad. So I think that's a pretty good start for having only been in office for a few weeks. So I want to just kick it over to Carlos Rosano to talk. And the basic question I want to start with is just kind of talk about what is your vision for a socialist future for Chicago, and what are some of the ways that you and your fellow socialist electeds can help to move us toward that vision? So Carlos, we'll start with you.
Good afternoon, everybody. Can you all hear me in the back?
Yes.
Great. So for those of you not familiar with Chicago, I'm going to explain a little bit about the unique role of an alderman. And an alderman is essentially a city council member. We do all the things that city council members do. We go to City Hall, we propose legislation, we vote on legislation that will impact the entire city. Now, as a result of a arrangement between the mayor and the alderman that has existed for many, many decades, over time, aldermen have given up their power to make decisions over citywide decisions, acting as a rubber stamp, and in return have received from the mayor an extraordinary amount of power over what is done locally in their district. And this is sometimes referred to as aldermanic prerogative. And so essentially the mayor says, you vote for every, you know, neoliberal privatization contract I put before you, you vote for every, you know, austerity budget that I put before you, you vote for every, you know, corrupt contract deal that I put before you, and then you can deal with the potholes, you can deal with delivered garbage carts in the ward, you can deal with the zoning changes on the little, impacting the little business in your ward. And so when I became an alderman, and I ran on a platform of making sure that we were taking on the big and powerful corporations that were too powerful at City Hall, and I ran beginning in July of 2014, and won with 67% of the vote in February of 2015, saying there are rich and powerful corporations at City Hall. We have aldermen that are voting with the mayor to make these rich and powerful corporations richer while we see divestment in our communities. So when I was elected on that message, like a good organizer, I went out and reached out to 50 of my colleagues, and 31 of them responded and said, sure, I'll get coffee with you, I'll do a one-on-one with you. And I sat down and so many of them told me, you're not here to change the world. You're not here to introduce citywide legislation. You know, focus on what's happening in your ward and deal with that minutiae day to day, and then, you know, let the folks at City Hall, the leadership, take care of everything else. Well, obviously as a socialist, that didn't sit right with me. As someone that saw the crisis of gentrification in my community, the displacement, the rising rents, that didn't sit right with me. As someone that saw the police state killing young black people, someone that saw ICE coming and detaining members of my community and causing terror and panic, that didn't sit right with me. And so one of the things that I sought to do immediately was to figure out how I could devolve the power that I had unilaterally to the people, right? So that people could understand that we don't need a billionaire, whether that be Donald Trump or J.B. Pritzker here in the state of Illinois, that we don't need any powerful boss, whether that be Mayor Rahm Emanuel, telling us what to do and controlling our lives, that we collectively as regular people could come together, regardless of our citizenship status, regardless of our level of education, and make the decisions that were going to impact us and the generations to come. So one of the things I'm also very clear on is that I'm under no illusion, as Lucy Parsons said, that the rich will allow us to vote away their wealth. And in my political office, because as an alderman you have to have your ward office paid for by government funds, and then we also have a political office paid for out of political funds, I have an art installation made by a Wobbly member, Ruby Pinto, who some of you may know, that has Lucy Parsons and the four martyrs from Haymarket. And right there, painted on her, it says the quote, you know, do not be deceived, that the rich will allow you to vote away their wealth. So what I seek to do is to, you know, empower people, for lack of a better term, to understand the power that they have, right, to take away the rich people's wealth and redistribute it. And what that has looked like in the context of being an alderman in the last 4 years is what we've called three people power initiatives in the 35th Ward. So we're seeking to build democracy, we're seeking to build socialism from the left and from below, and we're seeking to extend and expand democracy to every single aspect of life. So as an alderman, I have unilateral control over zoning decisions in my ward. And so one of the first things we did is we implemented community-driven zoning and development. And what that says is that no zoning change could occur in the 35th Ward without there being a robust participatory planning process, where people through organizations, through community groups, are able to weigh in and meet with the developer and negotiate directly with the developer and make demands upon the developer. And then that ultimately has to be ratified by a community assembly. And that community assembly has to take place in a area that is easily accessible. The meeting has to occur in the top two most used languages of the ward, which are English and Spanish. And the community has the ability to fill out comment cards at the end, and a tally is taken to see what the community actually wants to occur there. So since taking office, we have had 25 of these processes play out in the last 4 years, and every single time my final decision, because ultimately as the alderman I still have the control over that zoning decision, but every single time my decision in the zoning committee ultimately lines up with the community's process. So we've been able to do a couple interesting things around that. There was a developer that wanted to come and take a building and make six luxury like condos. This is a big building, it's a former warehouse. So these were gonna be like loft type condos. You can imagine each one was gonna sell for over $1 million. And the community said, that's not what we wanna see. We wanna see a significant amount of affordable housing there. Now ultimately, because private property rights are very strong in the United States, you know, the developer said, well, I don't want to include affordable housing in there, right? So there was that negotiation, right? Things sort of hit a standstill. So then some folks in the community said, well, why don't you consider a boutique hotel? So the developer said, okay, I'll consider the boutique hotel. And this was through the community-driven process, the negotiations happening between the community and the developer. And so the developer moved forward with the proposal for a boutique hotel. And then the community said, okay, great. We want you to agree to sign a community benefits agreement that every single job will pay a minimum of $15 an hour, and that 70% of the jobs will pay a Logan Square Living wage of $17 an hour, and that 70% of the people that you hire will be hired from the zip codes that make up the community. And so that is a concession, right, that the community is able to get from the developer. Another situation, there was a recently a developer that wanted to build a six-unit condo building on an empty lot in Hermosa. And Crane Chicago Business 2 years ago said, if you can't afford in Logan Square, now's the time to start buying in Hermosa, right? So they're telling you, this is, go west, right?
And new front.
Yes, the new frontier of gentrification. And so this developer shows up to this community meeting, and the entire meeting is conducted all in Spanish, right? Because everyone there was a Spanish speaker, right? So at time that the meeting starts, we ask at the beginning, who needs English translation, who needs Spanish translation? No one needed Spanish translation, so we all do the meeting in Spanish. And we're translating for the developer. And at the end of the meeting, the community wholeheartedly is just opposed to this. Everyone is just like, we were displaced from Logan Square, this is how it started, we don't want this to be built here. And so the community exercised their power, voted it down, and that developer went home empty-handed, right? So again, that's another example of how, and it's really powerful because so many of us are used to dog and pony shows, right? Good government in the United States has this rhetoric of, oh, well, we're gonna be inclusive, we're gonna be participatory, right? But we're very much used to backroom deals, we're very much used to those with power already having made an agreement, and us having to yell and scream at community meetings, right? Just to feel like we have some type of impact. But through the process of having these meetings, people have really now understood, right, that this socialist alderman is committed to giving them the power to make these decisions. And things, you know, people just really own that now, and it's a really powerful thing. The other thing we've done is every alderman allocates $1.3 million in ward infrastructure funds. Most aldermen do that based upon where the voters are. And where are normally the voters found? In affluent areas, right? Primarily white areas. And so when I took office, I found that the most affluent area of my ward was very well taken care of. They had brand new lights, they had brand new streets, brand new sidewalks, everything was brand new. And the areas that were most heavily immigrant, the areas that maybe only had 2-3 voters on an entire block with 40 homes, falling apart. Had not seen streets resurface in 15 years. So what we did is we implemented participatory budgeting, which is not a new concept. Came out of Brazil, has been around in the Americas for a very long time. But we sought to ensure that we were focusing on equity and that we were empowering people that were otherwise left out of the process because they were undocumented, because they were working parents, and making sure that they were really the protagonists in the allocation of these funds. And as a result of that program, we've now seen a more equitable distribution of that money, where the bulk of it has actually gone to the community of Hermosa, which is the poorest community that saw the least investment in infrastructure. And it has been working Latinx immigrant undocumented moms who have been the main ones going out there, organizing their community to say, we want to make sure that our needs and our wants are being met by this. So that has been a powerful way that we have done this as well. And one of the third things that we've done in terms of people power initiatives in the 35th Ward in the last 4 years is, after the election of President Donald Trump, I turned to my friends in Organized Communities Against Deportation, which is an undocumented-led group here in the city of Chicago, and said, what is to be done, right? What should myself as an alderman with these resources do? And they said, well, your office should set up a deportation defense network, a rapid response network. You should use the resources from your office and you should go out there and notify people of their constitutional rights not to open the door unless the ICE agent has a warrant signed by a judge, and even then you don't necessarily have to open your door, but you know the risk involved. And what we did is we initiated what is called the Community Defense Committee. And the whole notion of it is, let's think about public safety, let's think about policing outside of the realm of the police state. How can we as regular people keep each other safe? How can we police our own communities, right? From the aspect of protecting each other from state violence. And so since its foundation, the Community Defense Committee has knocked on thousands of doors, has distributed thousands of Know Your Rights cards to people in the 35th Ward. And we have also done things like civil disobedience trainings. We train people on what to do if, for example, there's an ICE checkpoint in the 35th Ward, how would we respond? And how would we create an obstacle to the ICE agents, deporting and detaining people in our area? What are the risks involved? What type of risk are you going to take? I'm sure many of you here are familiar with civil disobedience trainings. So that's something that our office does, right? This is an aldermanic city office, right? That is using those funds. Yeah, yay! So we're able to accomplish this, one, because of the unique nature of the aldermanic office, right? Where we have expense accounts, right, about $100,000, right, that we can use to print out materials, to fund these initiatives. We have the aldermanic menu money, the $1.3 million infrastructure funds, and then we have the unilateral control over zoning and development. So we've been able to accomplish that. But there's other things as well. So for example, when there's tenant unions forming in my ward, they use my office to meet. We open it up to other organizations that are fighting and organizing and agitating in the district. And then I always lend my voice, right? I'm the easiest ask. That's one of the things I always aspire to be, is one of the easiest asks for anyone that's organizing in a fight. So that when the tenant union said, can you call, right? Or a union says, can you call this boss, or can you call this landlord and make this ask and make this demand? Absolutely, yes. Let's schedule the phone call, give me the talking points, let's send the letter, let's get it done. Other things that have happened is our community-driven zoning process itself is participatory. And so 2 years ago, youth in the Lowenspur neighborhood came together and said, we think that the signs that announce zoning changes need to be more accessible to everyone. And so they came forward with a proposal that said, we want signs that are 2 feet by 3 feet. We want a color rendering of what the development's gonna look like. We want a plain English and plain Spanish explanation of what the developer's seeking to build. We want the contact information for the developer, right? What's their name, what's their phone number, what's their address? And then we also want information about when the community meeting, community assembly is gonna take place. And so we work with them to develop that. And now if your developer's seeking a zoning change in the 35th Ward, at your cost, you have to print out this sign and you have to post it on the building where you're seeking to make the zoning change. So that is something where, again, people were able to, you know, use their agency and their power to bring about that change in our community. So that's really the local work that we've been doing. I'm gonna veer very quickly into the legislative stuff and then wrap it up, because Miles, you're shaking his head. The other thing that I understand is that it's gonna take mass people's movements to bring about the change, right? It's not gonna be, you know, one socialist alderman or six socialist aldermen or 20 socialist aldermen giving very beautiful speeches or passing very, you know, powerful progressive socialist legislation. It's going to take a mass people's movement out in the streets, right? And hey, it's gonna be really beneficial to that mass people's movement when there's socialists in office. What I seek to do on the legislative end, right, particularly in my first 4 years being 1 out of 50, was figuring out where's the street, right? Where are those movements that are lifting demands, right? And how can I use whatever little bully pulpit that I have to advance their cause? And so one of the first things that we did was we started the Chicago Immigration Policy Working Group. And again, we used funds from my office to start that group up. And we brought together almost all of the immigration advocacy groups or immigrant ally groups in the city of Chicago under the purview of OCAD, Organizers with Organized Communities Against Deportation, and came up with a legislative agenda that said the city of Chicago should enact these pieces of legislation to protect and integrate immigrants. This is what the immigrant community is asking the Mayor Rahm Emanuel and the city council. And we push forward those demands through both using my office to reach out to the mayor's office and set up meetings, right? So we met with the legal counsel for CPD, right? Here are, you know, undocumented organizers, you know, sitting across from the legal counsel of the city and the legal counsel of CPD, negotiating directly with them on policies, right? But we also did it through protests, through civil disobedience, through sit-ins, through press conferences. So similarly, when Asada's Daughters and other organizers came to me and said, hey, there's gonna be this $95 million police academy, right? And we think that rather than expending more money on racist policing, instead we should invest in after school programs, job programs, mental health services, education, to really address the root causes of public safety in our community. I said, absolutely, right? I will be there with you, I will stand there with you. And was at one point the only alderman to vote no, right? But that's because I had clarity in terms of what my role was there to do, right? It wasn't there to make nice with the mayor. It wasn't there to make nice with my 50 colleagues, right? Sometimes I think that there's this delusion that if only I played more golf with the main, or if only I was better drinking buddies with Danny Solis or Ed Burke. We were never drinking buddies, but if only,
You would have been caught on a wire, probably.
If only I would have been a more effective legislator, right? This whole notion that the change is this game of statesmanship amongst gentlemen, right? Amongst the gentry. And it's a matter of reaching their heart and their mind. No, we're talking about power and we're talking about money, right? And we know that the response to organized money is organized people. And so what I sought to do in my elected office is to try and organize people, right? And understanding where are the people organizing themselves and how can I therefore use my voice to uplift their demands in hopes that that will lead to more organized people, right? To more folks coming out. And so at one point in time, so many of my colleagues hated me because, you know, it went from like 100 No Cop Academy activists to suddenly 1,000 No Cop Academy activists. And because they don't understand organizing, because they don't understand history, I would say, they thought that somehow this was like me, by myself, right? Like, they're like, Carlos, these are your people and control them. You know, why do you keep bringing them here? And it's just like, no, like I'm just like a little drop in the bucket, right? That's trying to add, right, to that force so that it overflows, right? And ultimately we get the justice that we deserve. So that has really been the approach that I've taken the last 4 years. And I'm so excited now, because now we get to amplify that 6 times more. And now I have folks that are in the same role that I am in, right? That we can collaborate, conspire together, alongside all of our movements, alongside you know, the DSA and other organizations. So with that, I'll turn it over to Rosana to build upon that.
I kind of failed at my duties as a moderator. I did not properly introduce either Carlos or Rosana. As you may have gathered, they are two incredible older people, but Carlos actually, not only was he reelected, he faced a machine-backed opponent that, you know, basically Rahm Emanuel helped to put up against him and was able to beat her by 20 points. Incredible. And then of course Rosana just won for the first time after having to go to a runoff. Her election was a little more difficult. But it's really incredible. I mean, she was able to take to beat Deb Mell, who folks don't know. She was the heir to the Mell dynasty. This is one of the most powerful political families in Chicago history, really. And Rosana, her first time running for office, was able to beat her. So, that's really an example of the type of sea change that we're seeing. And like as Carlos mentioned, this is an example of the kind of reinforcements that are now going into city council to work with him on some of these issues. So Rosana, do you want to just pick up on that and maybe talk a little bit about what your vision is and what you see? I mean, talk a little about like the, you know, you recently just, Carlos brought up tenant unions. You were just out on the street with tenants fighting against an abusive landlord, and you've only been in office for what, a month? So that's pretty good.
Well, I didn't beat them, Mel. We did. That we did it together, and we did it because we have been organizing for so long. So that was teamwork. Well, Carlos actually said everything that I was gonna say, so I don't have anything to tell you. No, I'll talk a little bit more in depth about the different organizations and the work that we're planning to do, but I do have to say that the fact that Carlos has been in City Council for 4 years, and that Carlos was fighting alone, well, with the people, but City Council, it can be a really hostile place to be. There's a lot of interests in there, and for somebody like Carlos to show up and be like, yeah, well, I'm with the people, it is a really, really difficult thing to do on your own. So Carlos not only went to City Council and started pushing for all this legislation that was necessary, but he started creating these models in his office that now become a blueprint for a lot of us that are taking office. So the fact that Carlos' office has already created a community-driven zoning process, and that I have witnessed what that looks like when people flood a place to come and say out loud and in Spanish that they want affordable housing, right? That that they can come and argue with the NIMBYs. Everybody here know what NIMBYs are?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. These are not in my backyard people, right? So to see these people outnumbered massively in a space by people who came because they understand that these resources belong to them and that they're gonna come take them, and that Carlos has been able to figure out how to provide that space. I have to make that happen. It's an incredibly beautiful thing, and to think that we can reproduce that in other wards is just, it's amazing. So thank you, Carlos, for your work. So I've been thinking a lot, reflecting about what we just did, and it is interesting to me that a lot of the context of the six different aldermen that just won, it's very different. So I'm going to talk a little bit about my experience in my community. As many of you probably know, we came out of the Team Vegan campaign, who was a history teacher that ran. We got involved in his campaign, and we were 17 votes away from a runoff with Deb Mel. And then
This was in
2015, and after we didn't get the seat, we created an IPO, an independent political organization called 33rd Ward Working Families. And alongside other organizations in our neighborhood, we started organizing mostly around immigration, immigrant rights, housing, and education. We canvassed a lot for Leave the Ban, for the moratorium on charter schools, and we were able to put these items on ballots, and we won all of them. So this was a process of building a volunteer base of people that were learning how to knock on doors, how to put the message out there. So we became really well organized, and alongside other efforts and other organizing efforts, we were able to win the seat. But I want to talk a little bit about the things that are already happening in our neighborhood that allows us to continue to organize that work. Because at the end of the day, the only reason to go get a seat, as Carlos said, is to be able to build people power, right? And now you have a seat that has resources, that has space. So now you throw that power line outside, right? And then you can get all the people that are organizing for the things that we need to get the resources that we need. Then now we have a space to do that. Now we have the resources to do that. One example, in 2016, after Donald Trump won, Albany Park Defense Network was created in my community. And the idea was to provide support to people who were going through deportation cases. So some of the work that we were doing around that was going down to court with people that had hearings. And that process, I really get emotional when I think about it, because I think that one of the most important things that we're building is actually solidarity. And the idea of APDN was to put out there is a hearing for so-and-so during this day, at this time, and it goes out to a lot of people, and a lot of times you actually don't know this person. You don't know who this person is. You have no idea who this person is, but you're gonna show up. And people show up, and they don't know who it is that is going to court, but you will show up, and you will stand there, and the judge is gonna see that this person has community, and you will be there because you want this person to stay in your community. So besides that, holding fundraisers, bailing people out of prison who are in detention, this is like urgent work, right? Like work that needs to be done very quickly. Lately, we have been organizing a network of volunteer mental health care providers that are on call, so that in case of ICE raids or sudden deportations, we can take care of families who are going through the trauma of separation. Which is something that is happening a lot, and we don't necessarily have the resources for people to access mental health care. So we have mothers that are losing husbands and are processing the trauma of their children while they're trying to keep it together themselves. We're trying to organize a fund so that people don't get displaced when there is somebody who is deported and is the main breadwinner. So there's a lot of, you know, issues that go with this horrible separation policy and with our broken immigration system. So all of those are things that before were very hard to do. We were doing it. So the initiative is there, but now that you have an office where people can come, and meet. Now that you have a lot more resources to organize a canvas like we did a few weeks ago, Carlos and I joined forces and both of our wards came together to do a canvas. People showed up overnight. 113 people showed up overnight. We didn't have time to promote this. And people showed up to gather materials and we knocked on like 2,000 doors to give people information about the raids, right? This is something that we are able to do because now we have offices and we have the ability to communicate with a lot of people and we have done the organizing work to be able to now use our office for that, right? So what else can I tell you that Carlos didn't tell you? Autonomous Tenant Union. So Autonomous Tenant Union is another organization in our community that has been doing incredible work for a very long time. They meet people who are facing either evictions or that are in slumlord situations where the living conditions are horrible. And they get in and they start organizing the tenants because it's a lot easier to fight an abusive landlord if you get together with your neighbors, right? If one person complains, it is very likely that you're just gonna get a 30-day notice and they're going to kick you out. And most people actually don't know that tenants have rights, right? So Autonomous Tenant Union does a lot of work around making sure that people know, tenants know that they have rights, and also making sure that people understand the power in fighting together. So we have been doing a lot of work with Autonomous Tenant Union to make sure that the landlords, now it's not just that there's a tenant union, now the alderman is looking at you and is supporting the tenant union that is being formed. So we, just like Carlos said, we send letters to make sure that the alderman knows that we're watching and that we are on the side, unequivocally, on the side of the tenants that are organizing, which is a really big change from what we had before. Where aldermen take money from developers and from landlords, and of course they're not gonna go and tell the developer anything. They're going to go tell they will tell the tenants, I can't do anything, that's his property, right? So now we can do so much more and we can support that work. In terms of vision, so I would say that there are many things that we think that we can do now. I am really excited about starting to think about how mutual aid projects can be implemented in our wards. I think that one of the most beautiful and important aspects of having institutional power is going to be to allow people to imagine what is possible, right? So I am from Puerto Rico, as probably many of you know, after Hurricane Maria, the thing that kept communities whole was mutual aid. So the idea of creating spaces where people can address their needs on their own by cooperating and collaborating, the idea of creating community kitchens, for example, the idea of creating collaborative spaces where people work and also get the services that they need. That is something that I am thinking really, really hard about, and it's something that I am hoping that we're going to start rolling out, and now we have the resources to do that, right? We have an office from which we can do that. I'm going to say, the last thing that I'm going to say is being in office means that now we can redefine what aldermanic services are, right? So far, people are used to the fact that an aldermanic office is where you get your garbage can and call for potholes or because your neighbor is being loud and you want somebody to go yell at them. And policing. People want to police everybody too.
And partially I think that, you know, that was just reinforced by how aldermen operated for so long as well, right? It was that's basically how they saw their jobs, much like Carlos was saying, as people just like ward superintendents essentially versus legislators versus people pushing forward policy.
Exactly. So the idea of expanding the services that we're giving now, the idea that In my case, I decided that I was going to hire a team of organizers because I wanted my office to be a space where we can organize from every possible position, right? My superintendent, who is somebody, that position historically is somebody that is out there looking at what's happening in the world, what needs to be fixed. My superintendent is a housing organizer. He's actually a member of Autonomous Tenant Union. So now, when my superintendent is out there and is looking at issues in the ward, my superintendent can give people information about how to organize a tenant union. That is part of our services. We will help people organize tenant unions. People in my office are immigration organizers, immigration rights organizers. We have had countless people that are come through the door to try to get help with immigration cases, and we can actually provide that service in our office, right? So the idea of using the office in that way as an organizing tool is something that we're very excited about, and it's definitely at the core of the idea of how do we get to advance socialist ideas in Chicago.
Get to questions very soon. I have one question myself first, though, because there's one initiative that recently got underway here that is being pushed by the Chicago Democratic Socialists of America, and now is, you know, being taken up as a campaign, and it's to democratize ComEd, which is the energy services here. And one of the people that recently brought that up on Chicago Tonight, which is our local kind of PBS public television station, was Carlos just the other day. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So as I said, one of the things that I have sought to do in my first 4 years is to figure out where the street heat is at, right? And a lot of that happened organically, right? So undocumented activists fighting to remove the carve-outs from our sanctuary city ordinance, Black youth fighting to, you know, defund the police. But in some ways, socialists too have also been pivotal at creating that street heat and being intentional doing that. So one of the first ways that we saw that was in the rent control campaign that has flourished across the city of Chicago and in many ways became a central point of tension in this past aldermanic election. You know, DSA endorsed the rent control campaign. They collected hundreds, thousands of signatures to get it on the ballot in different wards across the city of Chicago. So the state of Illinois has state preemption. They say no city can implement any type of rent control, rent stabilization policy. So DSA is fighting to lift the ban on rent control as part of a broader coalition. But DSA has been critical of around canvassing, knocking doors, getting the word out there, and uplifting that issue, right? And then I, as the local elected official, then use my bully pulpit, use my office to push forward, right, and agitate alongside, you know, the grassroots campaign that DSA is leading on. So similarly, you know, DSA in Chicago has now endorsed a campaign to democratize ComEd. So Commonwealth Edison is our quote-unquote public utility, right, which really just means that they get to be a monopoly with, you know, alleged really strong regulation from the state above them. And the city of Chicago has to enter into a essentially a franchise agreement with one of the utility companies, right, which historically has always been ComEd, right? ComEd always gets this agreement with the city of Chicago. And so ComEd makes an enormous amount of wealth off of this. We have seen, you know, utility rates rise. We have seen people unable to pay, and, you know, and have their electricity shut off. And so what we're seeking to do is, as the reporter at Chicago Tonight said, have a government takeover of ComEd. You know, democratize it, municipalize it, have public control. And so DSA now is going to initiate canvassing. Right, they're going to be out there talking to people. They also have an amazing number of individuals that are doing research, right, and are going to help us write the policy. And then, you know, the six socialist aldermen, we're going to be speaking about it at the press conference. Most importantly, we're going to be introducing the legislation, whipping votes, lobbying, pushing that forward. So that's one example of, you know, the way in which, you know, you can have this, what some would call an inside-outside strategy, but it's really about putting forward non-reformist reforms, right? Speaking to the needs of people, of working class people, and saying, look, we can have democratic control, you know, of the things and the things that we need in our life. And I think that one of the examples and precedents of this that we can look to in Chicago history is that socialist candidates at the beginning of the 20th century were standing alongside workers demanding municipal control of our mass transit train system in the city of Chicago. It was a big, big fight that occurred. And workers went on strike. There's stories of children joining the workers on strike because the workers were demanding public ownership of our elevated train system, our wonderful L system. There's stories of children bringing sheep onto the train to like disrupt it, right? And help out their parents and their uncles and their cousins and whatnot. There's, you know, 20,000 workers, you know, just walking out and having mass meetings and shutting it down. So socialists were running on this platform of immediate municipal control of the train system. It was becoming wildly popular. And then this one candidate for mayor is like, on the Democratic side, adopts the platform and ends up winning his election on this platform of immediate municipal control of the train lines, but then is thwarted by the courts and is thwarted by the capitalists and those that own the train lines for many decades. And ultimately wasn't until the mid-20th century that Chicago ultimately won control of the mass transit system. But I think that that's an example that shows, you know, how socialists have put forward these demands, right? And worked alongside the grassroots, right? The folks that are out there fighting and agitating on the ground. And I think we're seeking to do something very similar now with our campaign to democratize combat.
Yeah.